Medea Benjamin, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Medea, your work has been so interesting, and there's a lot that you've done. But I think we'll just stick with a couple of things and maybe begin with your work on this project called Code Pink, a women-initiated grassroots peace and social justice movement working to end U.S.-funded wars and occupations. So what is it about women initiating these kinds of discussions? Why should it be a women-initiated grassroots peace and social justice movement? And what beyond the trying to stop the war in Iraq did your organization do or does it do?
We started after the 9/11 attacks when George Bush did his color-coded alert system. I don't know if you or your listeners remember, but there was the code yellow, code orange, code red, and we felt that it was really being used to justify a response like the invasion of Iraq that had nothing to do with 9/11. And so we called it a code pink alert, saying there had to be a different way. Let's go after the individuals who attacked us on 9/11, but not invade countries like Afghanistan and Iraq. And we never wanted to be an exclusive women's organization, but we felt that the voices of men, or as we said at the time, the testosterone level was so high, we needed some women's rational voices. We had Osama bin Laden, we had Saddam Hussein, we had George Bush, and we had the drumbeats of war, 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 war. So we have been a movement that over the years really started out to try to stop the war in Iraq. We actually were in front of the White House for 4 months, I remember, because it was freezing cold. It was a very cold winter that year. And we were there day in and day out saying no to the war. We built up a very, very strong movement. We had about 300,000 people on our mailing list. We had about 300 groups throughout the country. And throughout the Bush years, we focused on trying to end the wars and redirect our foreign policy to one that focused on due process, international law, diplomacy. Then Barack Obama came in, and many people in our movement thought that, oh, he's the peace president, things will be a lot better. And the movement really fell apart, not just Code Pink, but the peace movement in general. We lost about half of the people on our mailing list. Most of the groups faded away. And we were still, as a core group out there, saying, wait a minute, if we're going to get out of these wars, we need a strong movement that's going to pressure Obama. Bush didn't listen to us, but maybe Obama will. Unfortunately, for a number of reasons, people thinking Obama was going to get us out of the wars on his own, people thinking I don't want to protest the first African-American president, people thinking, oh, the Democrats are the good guys on this one, or the financial crisis that meant that folks had to look inward on how to pay their student loans or keep their homes or find a job. For all of those reasons, it has been very hard to keep up a peace movement.
Well, so from what I understand, you are also wanting to redirect those resources and really focus on things like healthcare, education, environmental or sustainable development, other types of, as you, I think your organization put it, life-affirming activities, that not things that are killing people, but things that we need in order to perpetuate life. And so how have you been able to do that, not just to get out of wars, but to move resources in this direction?
No, it's been really, really hard. I used to work on economic issues, and we'd focus on a particular corporation, try to change its labor practices or change its environmental practices. And when I look back, I say, boy, was that easy, because you could protest in front of their store. You could go to their factory. How do you stop the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about? It is huge. This is a multi-trillion-dollar industry, and there is a revolving door between the weapons manufacturers and the Pentagon and other areas of government. And you find that even in Congress, there's tremendous support for the war machine because the weapons manufacturers make pieces of the equipment in just about every single congressional district. They have their lobby groups, they give money to Congress, and the wheels just of war keep churning. So it's been very hard. If I look back and I say, you know, what do we do? What can we say we helped accomplish? Well, perhaps it was not going to war with Iran, which was on the table for quite a while when the strongest political lobby group in this country, AIPAC, was pushing for there to be a, quote, military solution, bombing bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities. And we in the peace movement came out very strongly to stop that, and the negotiations are going quite well today. We also look at a year ago, things were very different because there was a broad movement that crossed ideological spectrums from the Tea Party to Code Pink that came out to say no to Obama's attempt to get the U.S. involved militarily in Syria when he said, you know, there was his red line and if Syria crossed the red line, we'd go to war. And the American people said, whoa, you know, we need another war in the Middle East like we need a hole in our head. No, let's not do that. And that war was stopped in its tracks. And instead, we got diplomacy and we got the deal that dismantled Assad's chemical weapons. So there have been things that we've accomplished. I also have worked a lot on the issue of drone warfare, where the government has decided, well, let's not do troops on the ground because our soldiers get killed and we don't like that. And the American people are tired of that. Let's instead use this remote controlled warfare where we press buttons out of Air Force bases here in the United States to kill people thousands of miles away. And I researched it, did a book called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, showing that this is actually making wars more likely because it reduces barriers to going to war. And so we have at Code Pink have been protesting at the bases, at the Pentagon, at the CIA, at the White House, standing up in front of the president when he gave his foreign policy speech last year saying, why are we killing people with drone warfare without giving them a chance to surrender, to be captured, to be tried, to have some kind of due process? Aren't we supposed to be a nation of laws? And we've had a lot of success in that area of reducing tremendously the public support for the use of drone warfare and forcing the government to talk about what was a covert program that they wouldn't even talk about, and forcing the government to reduce the number of drone strikes in places like Pakistan and Yemen. So there have been some successes, but I would say it's very, very, very hard to stop the wheels of this tremendously profitable military-industrial complex.
So in reference to your book, Drone Warfare, as you just referred to it, Killing by Remote Control, the book refers to the legal and moral implications of using drones. Now, I know that there's a lot of debate about the use of drones, and there's, you know, some argument to be made that there are times when you need to use these types of weapons when you don't put people on the ground. On the other hand, you know, you're killing innocent victims, as you've pointed out, and creating additional enemies. So, I mean, is there not some middle ground here in terms of standards and legal guidance for the use of these types of weapons?
Well, we've been using the weapons in places where we've been all out at war, like Iraq and Afghanistan. We've also been using the weapons in places where we're not at war, and oftentimes against the wishes of the elected government. So take the example of Yemen. There are about 200 people who were identified as being part of a group called al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in 2009 when the Obama administration started using these drone strikes. You look today and it's estimated there are about 2,000. Well, certainly it hasn't helped because every time somebody was killed, an entire village, an entire tribe would say, what? The United States just killed one of ours. Let's join up with this al-Qaeda group and go try to take revenge. What was an internal struggle gets internationalized when the United States comes in. I would say in Pakistan, most of the people that we have killed have either been low-level Taliban fighters, most of them teenagers who were maybe 9 or 10 years old at the time of 9/11, had nothing to do with that, or they were innocent people. And as you said, I think it's immoral, but I also think it's counterproductive. And if you just look at where al-Qaeda was based in 2001 and say, okay, mainly Afghanistan, fast forward to today, where is al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda-type groups? Well, we can go on with the list of Iraq, Syria, Libya, Yemen, Niger. We can go on and on throughout North Africa, Mali, Certainly, this has not helped. So I would say whether it's drone warfare, whether it's boots on the ground or other kinds of airstrikes, the U.S. military involvement has been the best recruiting tool for these extremist organizations that want to say that the West and the United States is at war with the Muslim world. And we are falling right into that trap. And here we're doing it once again now in Iraq.
So what are the alternatives to use? I mean, so they create enemies and that sort of thing. I mean, I think we can see evidence of that without a doubt. But what do we do instead?
Well, first of all, alternative actually that was used under the Bush administration is you capture people. You capture people and you give them trials and you use a legal system. But I look at the book at a study that was done by the RAND Corporation that looked at 268 examples of what were called terrorist organizations and how they came to their demise in the last 60 years. The majority of them were through either better policing. That means taking this as a police issue, you had to find individuals and, again, capture those individuals and put them on trial. Only 7% was through military action, and the other 43% was through negotiations, bringing people into the political process. And that's how most wars end. That's how most terrorist groups come to their demise, is through negotiations. I'm not saying that ISIS is a group that is going to negotiate at this point, but if you look at the situation in Syria, the only solution in Syria is negotiations. And we've tried it, but we haven't put enough emphasis on it, and we haven't brought the right people to the table. It's only the guys with the guns that have come to the table. I've been in Geneva at those talks, working with civil society in Syria to say civil society representatives, the ones who are the victims of all these guys with the guns, they have to be at the peace table. Women, there was not a woman at the peace table during these talks. So broadening that, bringing groups in and countries in that we have not been talking to, like Iran. We need to work with Iran if there is going to be a solution to the problem in Iraq, where the Shia government is supported by Iran, but has been alienating the Sunnis. And that's what gave the space for ISIS to become so strong. So those are some of the examples of the kind of negotiating, the kind of political solutions that we have to do.
But what are the obstacles to getting to them in terms of getting women to the table, getting the right people to the table? I mean, what is it that we need to overcome in order to, you know, employ and implement the alternatives that you've just outlined?
I would say one of the biggest obstacles is right here in the United States, where our media sensationalizes and really beats the drumbeat for war, where the political scene in Washington is so polarized that the Republicans will bash Obama for anything and want to say that he's not strong enough, that he needs to take a much stronger military stand. And then you have Democrats even in the party who are saying war, war, war. And I talked about the political system being embedded with the military industry. So I think our biggest obstacle is right here at home, is creating the space for diplomacy. Look at the budget of the Pentagon and compare that to the budget of the State Department. The State Department is a fraction of that. The State Department is really like the poor stepsister of the Pentagon, that doesn't have the funds, the resources, doesn't even, yes, we have a very famous person, Secretary of State Kerry, in the position, but he doesn't have the power. And so he tends to go also for the military solution. I think it's become somewhat of a I would even say a sexist thing in this country, where the military solution is seen as the tough guy, the way to go in and really get the job done, where diplomacy is seen as very naive and wimpy. Diplomacy is the answer. The problem has actually been the war and violence. That's not going to be the solution.
Well, Madea, thank you so much for giving us much to think about today.